Today is Friday, November 20th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Pat Greedyagin, spelled G-R-E-D-I-A-G-I-N. And my name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Pat. How are you today?
I am fine. And I'm going to say Greedyagin again because it's hard to capture just hearing it once like I told you about 3 days ago, but it's Greedyagin.
Gonna keep working on me until I get it right. It's Greedyagin.
And Greedyagin.
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 Yeah. Yeah. And as I was saying it, I was like, that's not right. I'm like,
I know, it's hard to remember when you're just grasping for it out of the thin air.
I think with the A in it, it stumbles me up.
Yeah.
But it's very clear, Greedyagin.
Yeah.
And so I'll just keep working on it. But I appreciate that
you're
stay on me.
Yeah.
I'll get it right. And this is part three, I don't know if I mentioned that or not, of this oral history series. May we have your permission to record this oral history interview over the phone?
Yes, you may have my permission.
Thank you. Last time you had kind of introduced us to your going to this seasonal law enforcement 5-week training. And that then you ended up on the river unit. And, of course, anybody who kind of knows river running knows that 1983 was a big water year. Can you pick that thread up?
Yeah, I can. But I think I need to re-establish a time frame because I sort of skipped over a job that I had that we didn't get to talk about. So I'm going to just start from the beginning and go to the end, and we're somewhere in the middle, but at least that'll put everything together rather than just trying to pick it up piecemeal.
Oh, good.
So in 1977, I was an SCA in the maze in the spring for 3 months. I was a SCA in the fall in the needles for a 3-month period, except the last month I got hired on as an emergency hire as a maintenance laborer. Then I was off doing other things. The next spring of 78, 78 and 79, I had long seasons as a backcountry ranger in the maze. They were 7 months long, more or less, maybe 8 months, I forgot now. And in the winters, I picked up odd jobs. In the fall of 79, I went to Law Enforcement Academy for seasonals on my own and ended up getting offered a job on the river crew as a seasonal, which I did for probably 6 or 7 month seasons in 1980 and 1981. And then early in the year in 1982, I had filled out an application and got hired as a permanent position as a maintenance laborer.
Huh.
So this was a big move for me because I went from being a seasonal employee to being a permanent federal employee, which gave me a lot of benefits like retirement and sick leave. No, I had sick leave, but retirement probably is a big one.
Well, I would assume it was possibly a steady paycheck for, 50 weeks of the year with holiday
yes.
pay and, all kinds
right.
of stuff.
Right. So I did that for about a year and a half.
Tell me about that. Wait
well,
right there.
Can I finish up my summer
okay.
first?
Okay.
Yeah. So I was a maintenance worker for about a year and a half, and I actually worked one of those summers, maybe 83, on the river. I was borrowed from maintenance back on the river crew, either some summer 72 or 73.
Okay.
Then in 1983, I think it was in the spring, I got a job back on the river crew as a permanent river ranger.
Okay.
So I was back working on the river, but I was a permanent employee with a subject to furlough job, which meant that I was off two weeks or maybe 4 weeks a year, which was fine with me because it gave me a chance to go do fun stuff.
Yeah.
So I did that for most of 83, 84, 85. And in the fall of 85, I did a temporary job, I took my winter and went to Joshua Tree. I was still an employee in Canyonlands on their books, but they allowed me to go work in Joshua Tree so I could get some front country law enforcement experience.
Oh.
And I did that during the winter of 85, 86. And then in the summer, I think, or sometime in 86 after that, probably summer or fall, I ended up transferring to the Grand Canyon. So that's a summation of my almost 10 years in Canyonlands in the different little pieces and sort of the chronology of that.
Good.
So we can back up to whatever point now.
I'm going to ask you for a little bit of clarification in this timeline. When I think of law enforcement for the Park Service as a permanent, I think of the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy in Georgia.
Right. Right.
Did you have to go back to that?
I did.
When did that happen?
In 1983, I think it was like July until October because it was really hot. So I remember there was gnats, and it was not the best time of year to be in Georgia. But I did go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in, we call it FLETC, near Brunswick, Georgia. And that was a 9-week course that then allowed me to be a law enforcement ranger as a permanent ranger.
Okay.
The classes are much longer now, but when I went, it was 9 weeks.
All right. And so when we're going to go back now to your permanent maintenance labor work in 82 into 83 on the river that summer of 83, a little while, but then you got swept off of that to FLETC.
Right. Correct.
So let's go through that. And
okay.
That might be what we do today.
Okay. So shall we say that the seasonal years on the river, I more or less described them, I think.
Yeah, you were talking about the Friendship Cruise, and you talked about the spike camp that was set up at Spanish Bottom and running a Zodiac, and a small but powerful outboard motor boat, and writing some tickets, a ticket for a dog.
Right.
Yeah, so that was good. And so I am interested now. You're a seasonal river ranger, and you're offered a permanent maintenance job. Did you have a sense, well, hopefully that'll get me back to the river? Or were you like, I want to do maintenance, and this is great?
No. At the time, and probably still so, or perhaps still so, it was really hard to get hired on from no status into a ranger job. And so people were being creative and finding permanent jobs elsewhere. I had a friend that went to work for the IRS. People would go to work for the Corps of Engineers. They were easier to get offered permanent jobs in, either as rangers, but oftentimes as administrative clerks or whatever job you might be offered. People
I see.
Would take it.
Right.
With the idea, at least in their head, that they would do it for a year or some period of time, and then they would start applying for ranger jobs again. And they would be eligible at that point to apply for permanent ranger jobs because they had permanent status. And if you didn't have permanent status, you could not apply for the jobs.
Okay.
So I had heard about these creative ways. Seasonals talk together, and people hear about someone that does something. So there was a test that was given by OPM, Office of Personnel Management, I think, that they would rank people on these scores or on the tests, and then the highest ranked people on the tests would be the ones that were eligible to be offered permanent jobs from. So if they wanted to fill a maintenance job, they'd go to this list of scores for people who wanted to work in Canyonlands, and they'd have to work through the top scores and offer people jobs. And while I was not that, I wasn't that experienced with maintenance, I was a pretty good test taker. And so I was able to qualify through testing to be a maintenance laborer. And I didn't lack common sense in that realm, and I was reasonably handy, but I know that there would have been some guys out there that had a lot more experience than I did and probably would have just been more useful in the big picture, but weren't as good at taking tests. And so anyway, I got the job and worked maintenance as the plumber's sidekick, as the painter's sidekick, as the an electrician's sidekick, you know, somebody that needed someone to hold the other end of a board or help paint the walls. I was that person that that they would recruit. We had a centralized maintenance group in Canyonlands that provided more skilled services, well, services, maintenance services to Canyonlands, Arches, and Natural Bridges. It was a centralized operation. And each of those places would have their own maintenance guy that might take care of the on-site stuff, daily on-site stuff, water sampling, the generators. But if they had a big project, then the people out of the central maintenance group based out of Moab would go out and help. So I spent time in bridges, painting houses, and up on the island in the sky, doing plumbing projects. I can't remember everything that I was assigned to do at this point, but I was always just working under the guidance of somebody that needed an assistant.
Okay. Where was the main maintenance yard?
Oh, boy. I know where it is now, and I'm trying to remember. I think it was close to where it was. It is now. If you know where it is now, it's.
I don't
remember. There's a road that goes. You turn at McDonald's in Moab and head down the Colorado River on the south side, east side of the river, basically there, a ways, and it's not too far back from McDonald's, maybe a half a mile there on that road.
Okay, so that's on the Moab side of the river, toward the river, but not. I think there's a road there that goes all the way to the river and then wraps around, goes through what's called the portal, and then heads downstream.
Right. So there's a road on each side of the river, and one that you might be thinking of goes through the portal and is where you would go downstream to launch a boat on the Colorado River down at Potash.
Yeah, that's on the north side. That's on the other side of the river from Moab.
Yes. Right.
But there's a road on the Moab side, too.
Yes, there is. Yeah, that goes a ways down there. And then it eventually is paved for, I don't know, 10, 15 miles, and then it'll turn inland and go along Cane Creek, I think Cane Creek Road.
Okay.
And you could drive clear down the Needles on a gravel road.
Okay.
It turns into a gravel road, so it goes on through there.
And the main yard was on that road or one of the roads near it?
It was on a road that fed into that road.
Okay.
Still kind of in Moab more than on that road, but if you were going to drive down that road, you would drive one of two primary ways to get to there was where this maintenance yard was.
Do you remember any of the people you worked with or anything about them?
Well, yeah, there was a Ward Tucker George, I forgot George's name right now. They must have been there for 20 years I think they had basically their life careers there. And they had worked together so much that they were just this team that were always cracking jokes with each other. And they'd go out on projects together. One was the electrician, one was a plumber. And they were just kind of fun to be hanging out with. So when I was working with them, they just were entertaining, basically. They didn't take anything too seriously. And so it was kind of a... it was fun, yeah. And then a fellow, Jay Pratt, maybe. There was a painter that I worked with more than anything to help paint the inside or the outside of houses as needed. And so I worked with him a lot. And I got along with them all just fine. I can't remember any others in particular right now.
And I was thinking one of the things that you might be charged with is the maintenance of the employee housing.
Right, exactly. So there were housing areas in all of the three different districts of Canyonlands, Needles, the Maze, and the Island in the Sky. There was housing at Arches. There was housing at Natural Bridges. And so, in fact, I think it was all had to do with employee housing projects, maintenance, upkeep. These guys were the buildings and utilities crew. There was also a crew that was a roads and trails crew.
Right.
And that was a major division. I wasn't with that roads and trails crew. I was with the B&U crew.
Okay.
And I don't remember working in a visitor center or anything like that ever. It seems like it was always in the employee housing area.
Okay. And it sounds like there could be a lot of driving time, especially if you're got to go to the Needles today and got to go to the Maze tomorrow.
Right.
There's a river that separates those two and a big canyon.
Right. The projects would be, usually you weren't going here and then there and here and there. You'd be working in one place for a while. And when we painted at Natural Bridges, we would go down there for the week and stay in an empty house and then drive back on Friday.
Ah.
So that was more efficient than coming and going. And I don't think we went out to the Maze. I don't remember going out there for maintenance at all. They had some newer housing out there because it was kind of the last place that got some housing. I don't remember going out to the Maze with maintenance. It was mostly up in the Island in the Sky, Bridges with the painting. Probably went to Needles a few times. I don't remember doing much in Arches either. But, again, this is a long time ago, and my memory is spotty on all that.
And Island in the Sky, I keep thinking that there's a visitor center there.
There is.
But is there housing there too?
There is. And
okay.
It's behind the visitor center.
Ah.
Now, when I was there, that visitor center was a trailer. Now it's a pretty nice building.
Mm.
And the housing behind it was more trailers.
Okay.
And I don't know if they've got some actual stick structures back there now. They probably do, but I'm pretty sure it were all trailers back there when I was there.
Okay. All right. And they were probably trailers used from Bureau of Reclamation or somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were inherited from somewhere else and, hauled there for...
Glen Canyon Dam construction or something like that.
Something like, yeah.
Okay.
There was always a rumor, by the way, there was a small little silver trailer that was out at the Maze that actually I lived in when I was a seasonal there, and there was rumors that it had been Ed Abbey's trailer.
Oh.
I don't know if that's really true or not, but people like to think it was. So, yeah, the trailers just got passed around and used and patched up and... the holes closed, the pack rats would stay out, and
right.
Life went on.
Right. And did you learn some good skills there for like the rest of your life? How to do simple electrical work and painting
Probably the painting more than anything. I didn't really get to dink around with the electrical stuff much. I might have been the person that fetched stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember once I got to drive a little Kubota tractor, which was really fun. We were filling up a ditch or something like that, and of course I had never been trained on it. These days you'd have to have training probably and certification to know how to drive it, but they said, sure, give it a go. And so I played around with it for maybe an hour one afternoon.
Fun.
And thought, oh, I want to get one of these. It was fun. But I think just some basic, my dad actually had built houses, and so I got paid a penny a nail for pounding subfloor when I was 8 years old, or 10 years old, actually, and was around that kind of construction and painting and sheet wall, sheetrock, muddying, and I wasn't unfamiliar with all of that. And I don't know that I gained any particular set of skills while I worked in maintenance. I just probably broadened my understanding of all the things that were components of this and how projects got put together.
Yeah.
Other than the painting, I think I did develop some ability to cut in with the trim, with the paintbrush, without masking.
Cool. Okay.
I enjoyed painting, actually. We turn on the radio, you know, and just listen to it, and you just zone out and think.
Do you think Ward and George had an inkling that you were just using the job as a way to move into law enforcement?
I think the whole maintenance crew, my boss, I can't remember his name, but he was a guy that hired me and would have assigned the crews to go here and there. I'm sure that he knew that I was not, I'm sure everybody knew that I wasn't really looking for a career in maintenance. I was just looking for a first step, and then I'd be sailing on somewhere else. And they seemed to tolerate that just fine.
Yeah, I'm sure you weren't the first one to do that.
Yeah, right.
And they'd say, okay, well, we're going to use this person to...
You know, actually, in the maintenance, I'm not sure that that many people had... Mostly maintenance was filled with guys that like to do maintenance.
Right.
So I'm not sure there was too many people that had gotten in there on the use it as I had as a stepping stone, but I was able to do that and did it.
Yeah, you passed the test, so they were like, great.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else about that time in 1982 and to the spring of 1983 that you think back on?
Like I said, I think I'm pretty sure I was loaned. So it must have been 82 that I remember I was loaned back to the river crew during the summer busiest period. Maybe it was in the spring. Maybe it was like for 6 weeks, because I think that the permanent guy probably had transferred somewhere else. So there was a hole, which is what I ultimately got hired into 6 months later. So since they were short a person, they asked maintenance if they could, pay for me for 6 weeks and assign having back on the river for temporary, and maintenance was fine with that. So I did do that, and then went back to maintenance, but applied for the vacant permanent job on the river in the fall of 82, I guess, and then sometime in the spring of 83, they offered me the job. I accepted it. Or maybe it was winter of, maybe January, somewhere between January and March, I think, is when I returned to the river crew as a permanent GS-5.
Okay. You'd mentioned, I forget his name, I have to go look it up in the notes that I'm making as we go along. Was it Ed? You'd rented a room with him, and then you were staying with him. Were you still staying with Ed there? So you had a place to stay in Moab.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
okay.
When I was in maintenance, and then when I was back on the river crew, I had I was just living with Ed, so that part was easy.
Okay. And then,
although what happened, I'll tell you, when I was back on the river crew as a permanent person, they didn't know what to do with me in the winter, really, because there wasn't much going on the river, like nothing.
Right.
And so they sent me out to the maze to hang out there for 4 months, because at least there was a contact station that needed staffing. So I would move stuff out to the maze in, I don't know, maybe November, and then I would move it back into Moab in March. And so I did that a couple winters. So, yes, I had a place in Moab, but I moved around a lot.
Did you still have your dog?
I still had the dog.
Okay.
And after talking with you before, I got to thinking, well, what happened when Ed and I were both on the river? I imagine I just had somebody else that I knew that I said, hey, can you take my dog for 5 days? Oh, sure. Just kind of casual and easy, it seems like.
Cool. Well, fun.
This gang of people that was there.
And so, what was your dog's name? Do you remember?
Chaz.
Did Chaz get a chance to go out to the maze with you for 4 months?
Yep.
Cool.
Yep. And yeah, he was a great dog, and I could go on with dog stories, but I'll just keep it to my story for now.
Okay. And I also wanted to mention Steve Young. Was he on the scene then, or did he come in later?
He came in later.
Okay, so we'll pick him up when he fits in.
I never worked with him, so he came in after I moved out of Canyonlands.
Okay, all right.
There was another fellow who was in Steve's job named Steve Swanky, in the late 80s, and he's the guy that got that having patrol boats at the bottom of Cataract Canyon going. And
okay.
then Steve Young came in after Steve Swanky.
How do you spell Steve Swanky's last name?
S-W-A-N-K-E.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah.
And so we'll let's and was Steve the one that then hired you on to the River Crew for permanent?
No, it was Jim Bragg. So when I was there, Jim Braggs was the district ranger, and he was there when I first started working on the river in 1980, and he was the river district ranger, I think, the full time I was there, because I don't remember, I didn't work for Steve Swanky, so it must have been Jim Braggs the whole duration.
What do you remember about Jim?
Well, it's not real complimentary. Jim and I were good friends, but he had some difficulties at work, and I just assumed not go into it.
Okay, fair enough. And so you're working for maintenance, and that's going pretty well. You've applied out of maintenance to get on the river in 83.
Right.
And 83 is an interesting year because it had a pretty good snowpack.
Right.
Nothing, you know, out of the normal. Certainly 1957 had a bigger snowpack, and there were many snowpacks bigger than that. But it kind of caught the reservoir people, the Bureau of Reclamation people, it caught them. They hadn't moved enough water out of the system in the winter of 82, 83. So that when 83 showed up, there was no place for the water to go.
I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, including us. We would get river predictions for what the river was going to be doing for the next week. I don't remember the time frame, but
okay.
You know what was expected. And I know we were on patrol, and in my memory, we were on patrol for the Friendship Cruise, and I think that was Memorial Day weekend. And we knew that it was getting high, like maybe it was running 70,000 through Cataract, which is pretty high. But it just shot up from there, and I can remember being just stunned, like, what? 95,000? What? It's 102,000 CFS? We were just all like, I don't believe this. What happened? Where's this all coming from?
Had anybody had the institutional memory for the higher floods historically, had all that been lost? In 1957, through Grand Canyon, was 123,000 cubic feet a second?
You know, Canyonlands was not a park at that time.
Right.
The park had no memory of it. And I really don't know who was running, I don't know who was running Cataract in the 50s or 60s. Like commercial outfitters.
Ken Slight would have been in there, and Georgie White would have been in there, and Frank Wright would have been in there, and gosh.
People that were no longer available, their information and their knowledge base was not available to, or
right.
Somehow the Park Service did not tap into that. I don't know if it was around.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know if Ken Slight saw 100,000 CFS or not. You know, maybe they were running trips, but did they run during that high water? I have no idea.
Right.
There was never any kind of stories that I heard from any of those, that older generation of the first commercial outfitters about those kind of water flows and the ones that were running there, which, you know, I think that they were just mostly a little bit newer generation or younger, but a lot of them were definitely older than me, and I'm trying to think if they would have been maybe Ken Slight's age, but the Quist brothers were up there.
Mm-hmm.
Dee Holliday, he was, you know, he wasn't as old as Ken was. And I don't think, though, that they were around, at least Dee wasn't running in the 50s.
Right, he wasn't. And Al Quist and Claire Quist, they cut their teeth with Mac Ellingson, and Mac had, That's ELLINGSTON, I think. Quist is QUIST. But Mac sure had. He'd seen high water in the 50s, and he had taught the Quist brothers how to row. Mm-hmm. But he was gone by then. He would have been timed out. So you're right. That generation of people who had seen that high water and knew how to run it were gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. So when the water came up, and I think caught all of us by surprise, there were some commercial outfits. I don't remember all the particulars now of who was there and stuff, but there were commercial outfits that were in the canyon and probably were some private boaters as well. I know that Sherry Griffiths was down there with what we would call, I think she had a J-rig, which is like a 22-foot snout with a frame in between. And I think her transom broke, as I remember.
That's where the motor hooks on?
Right.
Yep.
So there was suddenly, was it the end of May, maybe, right after Memorial Day, where it got super high and commercial outfitters were having some trouble, Sherry being one I specifically remember. It seems like there was another one or two who were, saying, we need to evacuate. We can't go through this. I think we evacuated some people out of there, but now I don't remember how we would have done that.
Helicopter or with the sport boat back upstream?
Well, we didn't. No, I think with 100,000 CFS, we didn't have boats that were running upstream at that point.
Okay.
The Zodiacs that the Park Service used were powered by twin 40 horsepower motors and then twin 50s, and we did not use them for going into the canyon at all. So we hadn't developed this, if they would have gone, could have gone through there, we hadn't developed that skill set or used them that way. We had a snout rig. I can't remember what year we got it. Maybe 83, maybe 84, maybe 82. So I don't remember, but it just ran off of like a 40 horse or something. It didn't have much power.
Right.
And so there are some folks now that do sport runs through with smaller, like NavTech, I think, maybe.
That's right.
But they weren't running in 83. So I'm not sure that there was a set of boats that could have gone down there and got people and come back upstream.
Okay.
So I can't remember quite how that all worked out. I'm sure there's records of it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
What I do remember was that we shut down, I didn't, but my boss consulted with his boss, and they closed Cataract Canyon. No more new launches for like 5 days.
That was Jim. Jim Braggs would have done that?
Jim Braggs, right. He would have, of course, got the superintendent to do it. Because he wouldn't have had the authority to do it, but he would have told his boss, who would have talked with the superintendent, and they would have said, okay, let's close this down. And then we started letting people go through again after 5 or 10 days when things kind of settled down and people knew what they were getting into.
Okay.
And that's mostly all I can remember other than, so we had the what we call the fly camp, a spike camp down at Spanish Bottom. I can remember being there. We had this chalkboard that we would write down what the flows were each day. And Barb Warner had been a commercial guide, and she was a seasonal river ranger. So she and I were down there at Spanish Bottom writing 107,000 CFS, maybe 105, I can't remember. And the water's lapping at our feet.
Right.
I have a picture of that somewhere in my stuff.
Love to see it.
Or I had. Maybe it's in Canyonlands.
Yeah.
Possession now. But we would call in and get what the flows were and what the weather forecast was. And it just was surreal to have the water so high. I do remember hiking on foot from Spanish Bottom down to about Rapid 8. I think Rapid 8 was what they were calling the North Seas.
Yes.
Because it was just massive waves And I watched Western expeditions go through with, like, they had, I think, five pontoons, so single pontoons lashed together side by side, maybe a few more.
Yeah, the Western J-rig for Jack Curry is a number of these long tubes tied together with a little motor well in the middle.
Right.
And it's a pretty stable boat. It's very,
pretty
big.
Broad. Yeah. Pretty broad, pretty big. And I remember watching them go through these waves. And, you know, they basically, from stem to stern, the wave was bigger than them.
Wow.
They were real stable and went through. But
right.
It was great seeing their boats on the waves for scale to realize how big this stuff was. It was monstrous.
So, at the spike camp, the board that you used with the numbers on it, would you use your radio to get the stage gauge from, what would it be, Green River, Utah, and then up at Cisco or something like that, and then you'd add those numbers together?
Right, exactly. I'm glad you thought of it, because it wouldn't have come out of my memory so well, but yeah, we got Cisco and Green River and added them together and said that must be what's in Cataract.
So there's two main arms coming together at the confluence, the Green River and the Colorado River, and both of them have gauges to measure their volume further upstream. And so you add those two together. Now we do it on a computer in the comfort of our own homes. But back then, you would have had to talk to someone in the USGS to get that data. I guess.
I don't know if it was automated somehow with a phone call.
It might have been. That's true.
I don't know, but it wasn't something we were getting off the computer, that's for sure.
So you were adding up the math. There's a big cottonwood tree there at Spanish Bottom.
On the lower end?
Yeah, and I'm thinking, was the water like right up to the base of that cottonwood tree?
I think it was.
Wow.
We were camped on the upstream end of that.
Okay.
And, you know, there's been a fire down there since that time.
Mm.
So I think some of those big cottonwood trees, we had the lower camp down at the very downstream end where the big cottonwood tree was. There was a campsite there that was regularly used.
Right. Still is today.
There was one at the middle and which maybe that one's kind of not so good.
It still is today, but it's got this wicked bank with this log that's got little steps carved in it. You know, you got to carry all your stuff up there and then carry it all back down again at lower water. The high water would be nice.
Yeah. I was down in Spanish Bottom maybe 3 years ago.
Cool.
It was definitely different than when I worked there. There was the campsites were not as large.
Okay.
And I think some trees burned down in the middle camp. Anyway, there was a fire that went through there. There weren't wasn't the shade. So it is a little different now, but and we camped on the upstream end where I don't even know. It's kind of a sandy area. I don't know if there's much of a camp there now.
Yeah, there is the upper Spanish Bottom. There's still upper, middle, lower, and then now there's the lower has an upper and a lower camp. The lower camp can get flooded out, and then it just kind of one big camp there with two trips.
So we were on the upper end there, and there's not such a steep bank.
Right.
At least. And so I know kind of where the water came up to the base of those hackberry trees that were in that camp.
Yeah.
Or close to it.
Wow.
And I can't quite remember what it looked like down at the lower end in terms of where the water came up on the bank there, but it just was big.
Yeah, it would have been bigger than anything anybody'd seen in quite a while.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, logs, trees going by, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. Which was another whole huge hazard. Let alone the waves. Sometimes you had these massive trees that would get jettisoned in an upright trajectory and, you know, come blowing up at people's boats and stuff like that. I don't remember a specific accident involving that, but I do remember that it was troublesome because maybe your oar was trying to get a bike there, and there's a tree that suddenly shows up from who knows where, and yeah, the debris that was in the water at times has been a problem, and I'm pretty sure it was a problem then.
Yeah, yeah. So shut the river down for 5 to 7 days, and then open it back up again. Seems like the big boats were going through, and that kind of makes me think of cataract. Any year at high water, the big boats go through, and the little boats, they might try it, but, you know, it's...
Well, there was a little, I know there was a few people that specifically said, oh, I'm going to row my 16-foot boat through because, you know, this is going to never happen again.
Mm.
There were some private boaters that wanted to go down there and row it. Not many, and they were, you know, they were good boaters.
Right.
I can't remember how many of them flipped or, you know, how it all turned out, but there were some private boaters that didn't want to miss a chance to make history in their own way.
Yeah, and do you remember any of their names?
Well, again, this Barry Miller that was a ranger in Westwater, I think he was part of a group that went, but I don't remember anybody else.
Okay.
I'm not sure he went, but I think of him doing that, and I don't know who his cohorts were.
Mm. Did you get a chance to get down to what are called the big drops during the high water to see what they look like?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't. You know what? I'm trying to remember now. There was that might be when I think three of us rented a plane. I know we rented a plane and had the pilot fly us down over Cataract, and it must have been during high water, because why else would I ever?
Right.
I know I did that, but I don't remember when, but I'm thinking it must have been when the high water was there, because we must have just wanted to see what the high water looked like. So maybe I did see it from the plane. The only thing I can remember about that plane trip was the pilot said, do you want to fly through Corona Arch? And we all looked at each other and said, huh? Okay. You know, and he's a hot dogger, and he flew through Corona Arch, and somebody reminded of me of that like a few years ago, and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And they thought, I mean, that's kind of a crazy thing to do. He shouldn't have been doing that, and we should have said no, but we were like, huh? What? I never heard of such a thing. And we did fly through Corona Arch.
And the plane was up, tipped up sideways when you went through?
I don't remember that. I just know that I'm going to say we did, but now I'm pretty sure we did. I can't remember it specifically, like how the plane was angled or the moment of terror of going through or anything like that, but...
There was just the Moab Historical Society. I just happened to click onto it. Just had a talk a few nights ago with an old pilot, and there's a behind him was a picture of flying through, I think it was Corona. The plane is way up on its side. It's the only way it can get through there.
And that's how we did it.
Okay.
And it probably was that pilot. I wish, if you knew his name, I might recognize it. But, it, you know, very well could have been that pilot.
Yeah, today he's a very old man.
And he was a regular pilot out of the Moab Airport in the 80s.
Yep.
So that all kind of adds up.
Yeah, yeah, that might have been him. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That might have been me in the plane.
Well, it could have been. it's a photograph you look at and you go, oh my.
I know.
And then you know, the water dropped and went back down to normal levels again, and of course the reservoirs downstream were all letting water out like mad because they were full to overflowing,
right.
And that went on for a long time to get those levels back down.
Right.
And Flaming Gorge upstream was doing the same thing, letting out a lot of water for a while.
Yeah, I can't remember how long the water stayed up at a very high or a pretty high level, but it seemed, for some reason, I want to say that it lasted a while, and probably did last a while if Flaming Gorge was dumping water and there was just still snow coming out.
Right.
I don't remember that part.
Yeah, I'd be good. I have to go back to the gauge at Green River and call that up and look at the hydrograph and see what it was doing. But then it sounded like before the water dropped, you got swept away to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy in Georgia. When did you apply for that? Or is that something somebody just said, hey, Pat, guess what? We're sending you.
Yeah, it comes with a job.
Okay.
Because they had switched all those river ranger jobs to be law enforcement. When you accept the job, then the Park Service, like my boss, must have said, okay, I got another person that needs to go to FLETC, and then the Federal Law Enforcement Center will put the name in the queue, and when they've got an opening, then they assemble classes routinely with a person from here and a person from there. So I just got put in the system, and my number came up, and I think it was July that I started. It was very hot, and it wasn't the heat, it was the mugginess that was the...
Mm.
Yeah, so I was there for 9 weeks.
Did you take Chaz, or did you leave him?
No, I must have left him with Ed.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you drove your little VW bus out there?
I drove my little VW bus out there.
VW Bug, yep.
Or it was a Bug, yeah. Yep. It was a Bug, and kind of, made a little adventure. To me, these road trips and stuff to places, especially if I haven't been there, are like little mini adventures. It's like, wow, they're going to pay me to drive to Georgia. Cool.
Yeah.
So I did, and the class was a mixed group of people from land managing agencies. So it wasn't all Park Service. There were probably at least two-fifths Park Service people, maybe even three-fifths, but there were people from BLM, the Forest Service, and the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Oh, wow.
I guess that's probably it. Maybe there was like a Corps of Engineers person or two. So we were all managed federal lands and got the same basic kinds of training about, this is how you do arrests, this is how you defensively drive or pursuit drive in cars, this is how always get a warrant, that was drilled into our head. Mm. Just don't go searching around, always get a warrant. So it was what I had as a seasonal for 5 weeks, but now expanded into 9 weeks with more detail and depth. And
okay. Studying the law and
studying some law.
Defensive tackling.
Defensive tactics, shooting again.
Okay.
Qualifications. And I think now it's a 15 or 16 week course.
Mm.
I think it's 16 weeks.
Okay.
So they have expanded it, but at the time I went, it was 9 weeks.
Were you doing sort of the get up in the morning and take a run, or do some exercise type activities, or was it show up at 9 and we're going to do this training and go home at 5? And
yeah, it was mostly a probably 8 to 4:30 with half an hour for lunch, or maybe an hour for lunch, I can't remember. And there was a cafeteria where we would go and eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we did have physical fitness standards that we had to pass in order to qualify to be, to get our certification. So there was a mile and a half run, there was an agility run, there was a bench press, there was a flexibility test and a body fat test.
Okay.
And you had to fall within 70%, I think, or greater than a national average, or I don't know what the standard was based on.
Mm-hmm.
So there were qualifications. And so there was like a gym to work out in. I had been a jogger for exercise prior to going there, but it was so hot that to go and humid, it was it was uncomfortable to go running. But what I did is I had taken my bicycle on my car. So I had my bike there, and I would get up early, like at, 5:30, let's say. And I would ride my bike for 45 minutes or something round and round the campus. Because the thing about riding a bike is you create this little breeze.
Yeah.
And so you don't build up your body heat as much as when you're just jogging.
Right.
So it actually was a pretty good way to try and get some exercise in that environment.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Yeah, I tried to maintain my fitness while I was there so that I could pass the test.
Mm, good for you. Was there anybody in the course that you knew?
No.
Okay.
No, everybody was new to me. Of course, when you spend 9 weeks like that together, you get to know people pretty well.
And yeah.
So three other people that, you know, I became chums with there, over Labor Day weekend, which was like a three-day holiday for us, we went to the Bahamas.
Oh, wow.
So we decided, hey, what are we going to do? I don't know. Hey, let's go to the Bahamas. Someone came up with the idea. It's like, oh, yeah, let's do that. So we went, drove to Jacksonville, got on a plane, flew to Nassau, rented a car, and they drive on the opposite side of the road. So the guy that was driving forgot. You know, we're all like, we stayed in some, I don't know, condo thing or something like that and went swimming. And, you know, it felt like we were really making the most out of our weekend by going to the Bahamas for the weekend. And then back Monday morning, back to class. So I didn't know people when I went, but my roommate and I got along real well. It turns out she now lives in Bend.
Oh, wow.
And I went in to get some physical therapy training one time. I walked into this office, and I hear, Pat Grandigan. She was from the South.
Huh?
Her name was Sandy Hand, and she was working in this physical therapy office there.
Oh, my.
In Bend, Oregon. So it was great to see her. We got along, you know, we all got along just fine. I can't remember anybody being
fun.
Obnoxious or...
No, I would assume that 9 weeks you might meet some people who you know for the rest of your career.
Yeah. You know, I didn't end up turning... Well, maybe because so many of them were not park... A bunch of us were park service, but then there were a bunch that weren't.
Right.
And the park service is all across the U.S. So there were... I don't think I ever worked with people from that class. My seasonal class, there was a woman named Pat Buccello that was in that, except her name was Pat Baker at the time, and she was working at the Grand Canyon when I worked at the Grand Canyon. So that is one place where I ran across someone from one of my training classes.
Okay.
But generally speaking, I didn't. You know, people went on with their careers in different directions and just didn't see each other that much more.
When I talk with... I think it was Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E, and Butch had mentioned that they kind of warned him when he graduated from FLETC to be careful, because you sort of might have a sense of knowing too much or you know, being ready to take on things you weren't quite ready for. Did they mention that to you at all? Or does that ring a bell? Or?
I have my own reactions, and I'm going to try and sum them up here. I'm trying to think if anybody warned us about that, and I don't remember that specifically, but they did basically repeat many times, you know, to always be watching people's hands and to be ready for the unexpected, and basically to be on guard, which is a good thing to impart to someone. But in a way, it can get warped when you go back into a park and are wanting to be approachable as a friendly ranger, and you've got to find that delicate balance between being ready and on guard for the, you know, oddball thing that might happen, but still being casual and approachable. And I can remember that coming up when I was later in my career supervisor with a seasonal ranger who kind of was always, you know, I counseled him about being more approachable and not being a stiff and law enforcement approach to things, which would put the normal visitor off. So anyway, that's what I remember from my training, was that they wanted you to be alert. And I do agree that is a what you need to be doing. But some people became paranoid, and that became, I think, a liability.
Yeah.
With me, what happened was I went back to Canyonlands, and I had all this basically book knowledge or training,
right.
But I didn't have a chance to really develop on the job skills from that.
Oh.
because I was a backcountry ranger, and
yeah.
I just didn't interface with problems that would reinforce what I had learned at FLETC and that I could build upon. So I didn't get experience doing law enforcement that you would get if you went to the South Rim and were doing road patrol on the South Rim.
Right.
And were called to DUIs at night at, you know, somewhere.
Bar fights and concessions, employee drug problems and...
Right.
Yeah.
So there are places in the Park Service where you can get a lot of experience much faster.
Hmm.
Canyonlands was the opposite end of the spectrum where you know, I wrote one dog citation, I think.
Right.
And so that is why in 1985, I'm jumping ahead to a year or two, I felt like I was forgetting the stuff that I had learned at the academy because it had not been reinforced and I hadn't had the experience at work to really complement it. And so I asked if I could do a detail. When I went to Joshua Tree for that winter, it was on my initiative, me asking my boss, listen, you know, I feel like I'm not well prepared for if something really does happen now because I haven't had any experience. Can I go to a place where they do road patrol, where I can get some experience calling into dispatch? We didn't have a dispatch in Canyonlands.
Really?
Canyonlands was small time. Yeah, you're used to Grand Canyon. And
yeah.
Canyonlands is just a small operate. Now they probably use the county sheriff for dispatch.
They use Glen Canyon.
Or Glen Canyon,
yeah.
Right? But we didn't do road patrol. You know,
huh?
We didn't call into dispatch, okay, I'm going to be out with this car.
Right.
Because we were in backcountry settings almost all the time, both on the river, but even in the Needles District. They weren't doing road patrols and pulling people over.
Right.
It was,
huh.
It was a different kind of rangering there.
Very much so. Gosh.
I was feeling uncomfortable being responsible to do law enforcement if something serious did happen without having worked with it. At all. And so I ended up in 1985, 86, that winter, going to Joshua Tree and doing road patrol and calling dispatch, you know, to let them know I was pulling somebody over,
right.
Or, you know, what my, I didn't even know what the lingo was or the procedures. I think maybe we had a small introduction at FLETC, but mostly that's stuff that you learn on the job, which I'd never learned on the job because we didn't do it.
Huh.
Or I didn't do it, especially as a river ranger. So I did get that experience later and felt better because I figured out, okay, so this is how it's all supposed to work. But when I came out of FLETC, I had a good grasp on the training that they had offered, and I was ready to be vigilant, but nothing was going on the River District. So,
right.
You know, I lapsed. I always wanted to be just a friendly ranger anyway. I really didn't have an interest in doing law enforcement unless someone was vandalizing a petroglyph, and then I would have been happy to bust them.
Right.
Or cutting down a tree, then I would have been fine, you
right.
know, having them stop. But that wasn't doing road patrol never was an interest of mine. It just
it's funny you're bringing back memories. There was a really nice guy I had a chance to work with at Grand Canyon, and he was in a management position in law enforcement at the park. And we'd always high-five each other and just, you know, I'm a touchy kind of guy, so I'm always going for people's shoulders and, you know, that kind
yeah.
of thing. And one day he said, hey, I want you to meet this guy. And a gentleman walked up full Class A's, hands-on or near weapon.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm doing the high-five and touchy thing, and I reach out to shake this guy's hand, and he steps back.
Yeah.
And... I just said, hi, how are you? And I'll see you later. I got to go. And then later, I went back and I said, what was that all about? And he said, that guy needs to learn exactly what you're talking about, Pat.
Yeah.
Which is how to be approachable by people who are not a threat and to figure that out.
Right.
But
right.
Gosh, it's got to be, you know, when all you hear is when that failed, the default will be defense.
Right.
So I can really appreciate how difficult that is.
Right. And when you come out of FLETC, they want you to not fail. And so they really pump you up to be, you know, get your adrenaline going. There's bad guys out there. They're going to get you. And,
right.
And that has a role, but it also has a downside.
Yeah. So in a way, it sounds like going to Canyonlands after FLETC might not be a bad idea, because it helps you kind of get rid of that bad guy syndrome.
Yeah.
But then, you you have to build it back up again.
Right, right. And I didn't necessarily build up. I mean, I hope I maintain a level-headedness about, something hinky's here. You know,
that's right.
I am going to. But I didn't have a chance to do law enforcement, which actually would have made me more of a liability as time went by, because I didn't have automatic skills. I would have had to think through, okay, now what am I supposed to do? You know, because it wasn't automatic.
Right.
But nonetheless, I did go to FLETC. I did become a federal law enforcement officer on the river. And then I went back to Canyonlands and continued being a river ranger, which is really what my interest, where my interest was being outside and being a ranger and looking for peregrine falcons on the walls and talking to people about where campgrounds were and just doing the ranger thing.
I'm assuming on the river, you might have had your weapon somewhere in an ammo can or in a black bag, wrapped in plastic baggies or something to keep it from getting wet. It would not have been on your hip.
Right. I think we did. I mean, there probably were times where I didn't even bother to take it.
Okay.
It could be. I can't remember exactly, but I was not overly wanting to encumber myself. And
you probably weren't wearing a bulletproof vest.
No, not at all. Yeah. And so I had river ranger jobs after Canyonlands and in Big Bend National Park and then Dinosaur.
Yeah.
And I know at some point I definitely was, it became routine to have the weapon with me somewhere in my possession, but I never wore it on the river.
Right.
I always had it in a little ammo can, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure that the incidence of actually needing a weapon around river runners, it borders on rare to none.
Right.
So, right. But still, it can happen, so I get that.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. So 9 weeks, that would have ended in the fall of 83.
Right.
And then did you come back to Canyonlands? And they would have had to, what are we going to do with Pat again in the winter? They send you out to the maze again.
Right. So I came back, I don't know, I came back in the middle of October, and sometime shortly after that, I would have gone out to the maze for that winter of 83, 84.
Okay.
Next summer, just doing the same kind of river ranger work, going back to the maze. No, 84, 85, but then 85, 86, I went to Joshua Tree, which I can get to in a minute. But one, I want to jump back to 84. It was high water again in Canyonlands in 84. I don't know if you remember that.
No.
There was 2 years in a row that I think it was 100,000 CFS again. It sounds so incredible when I say that, you know, maybe you can check for me and see if that's accurate.
I can, yeah. I'm amazed when you look at the historical hydrograph. Every 10 years, there's 100,000 CFS flow.
Really?
It's fascinating that the we've been in this amazing drought for a couple of decades now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, going back in the record, 200,000 to 300,000 in the last 150 years, there's been some big water. going down through these canyons.
Yeah. I think that it was 100,000 again in 84.
Okay.
I don't remember anything going on the river. Maybe we knew about it in advance. Maybe we cautioned people about it. I can't remember anything that we did special. We probably did something special in terms of warning people, but I don't have any memory of anything specific to that other than the sense that it did happen and that it was like, wow, again, how weird. So that's the only thing I wanted to bring up was that I think we had two high water years in a row. The second one was a lower, it was smoother. Things didn't go nearly as badly as they did the first year.
Right. I think it's great. I mean, to have a real river that has real spring runoff when there's lots of snow is wonderful. It's what builds sand, big sand piles. One of the things that's in Canyonlands now is otters. Did you ever see any otters? There are.
No.
It blew me away when I saw one. What is that weird looking creature? And then I went, oh, look, there's two or three of them there. They're otters.
Wow. What was it, on the Colorado or in Cataract?
In Cataract. It was near, the lower end, a mile long. Above Ben Hurt.
Wow.
And we camped at this little sandy beach just below the rapid, and there was a lot of noise there from the rapid. I walked up and was looking at the rapid, and I looked down, and just 15 feet in front of me along the shore was this whole gaggle of, what do they call it? Something of otters. Anyway.
A pack? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't spent much time around otters.
A family.
family of otters, right.
And I was just like, where's my camera?
I don't have any memory of there being otters there when I was there. Now, maybe there were and I just didn't see them. But I don't remember other people seeing them or talking about them.
Beavers? So. Any beavers?
Yes, I can remember beavers. And I can actually remember one when I was at fly camp once. Swimming out on a beach near where I was sitting, and it had this little stick, maybe an inch and a half in diameter, like maybe a willow, I don't know what, maybe 15 inches long, maybe a little shorter, and it kind of sat up on its haunches in a way, and it kind of ate that stick like you eat corn on the cob. It just rotated around and was
ate the bark
on it.
Wow.
And ate the bark off.
Huh?
And I just watched it eating on this, the chewing the cambium, I guess. And it was so cool to watch. I do remember that specifically.
Wow.
It wasn't that far from me. It didn't do anything.
Uh-huh.
I just sat and watched it. So,
wow.
Yeah, there were beavers there. It was a fun one. You could see one like that.
So this may not be the case, but did you notice a difference in the wildlife in the Green River Arm versus the Colorado River Arm?
I did not.
Okay.
No, I can't say as I don't remember that much wildlife. There were beavers. You could see beavers slide sometimes, you know, off the bank or something. So I don't remember there being a difference in the beavers. But I don't remember many deer.
Okay.
I just don't remember much wildlife down there, actually.
Okay. Yes, one thing we've noticed is it seems like there's more herons on the Green River Arm than on the Colorado Arm. Now, that could have just been when we were there, and it's got nothing to do with anything.
Right. But maybe it is the case. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Yes, that's you know, an odd snapshot from today, and I'm just kind of curious if there's a correlation back, you know, 30 years ago, to kind of figure that out. So, so went through Fletsy, back on the river then in 84 and 85, anything else you remember about those river years, 84, 85?
No, nothing that specifically outstanding. I always loved, you know, being a river ranger. It was work that I really enjoyed doing, but I don't remember, I can't remember anything specifically outstanding, like, you know, the year that this guy did this and we had to chase him down.
Right.
I don't, you know, nothing like that.
Yeah, it's pretty quiet on the river. It's people with dogs,
yeah,
and, you know, that's about it.
Right.
The occasional, hey,
right,
that's a dog there.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned the park got a J-rig. Did you get a chance to drive that down through Cataract and out to Height,
well,
I guess, would have been the takeout?
Not. I mean, well, no. I did not have a strong urge to become a motor boat, you know, a motor rig driver.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Ed Forner and Jim Braggs sort of took on. So when I first got there, we just had rowing rigs. And as a matter of fact, they were old Army surplus Green River neoprene, heavier than,
yep,
than anything, rafts. And then sometime, like in the very, maybe 80, well, I think I rode those for at least a year. So maybe 82, we got some, 81, 82, we got Avon rafts.
Ooh.
Avon Pros, I guess. Are those the 18-foot ones?
Yep.
Anyway, they were bucket boats.
Yep.
I think everything was at that time.
Yep.
And so so that was what I ended up, I would row those boats.
Uh-huh.
And then the J rig came in maybe 83, I can't remember. And Ed was operating it most of the time, and Jim Braggs would operate it. I just had no interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
So what we would do is sometimes we'd do a patrol with a couple rowing rigs and the J rig, and then when we got down to Height, or I mean to the bottom of Cataract, we could tie up and motor off.
Right.
With the J rig,
right.
And so going off or even upstream in the flat water, sometimes I would just take a shift and run the engine. So because you're just motoring off the lake or something like
right.
that. But
right.
I never had any skill or training or interest in learning how to run the motor rig through the rapids.
Did you guys ever take the chance below the big drops once you got down on the reservoir to hike up to the rim country at all?
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, what's Glen Canyon?
Outside,
it's not, yeah. It's
yeah,
outside
it
Canyon
Canyon.
Yeah.
Although, here's something I remember that you just reminded me of, because we camped in Dark Canyon one time.
Oh.
And would hike up Dark Canyon a little bit because it was fun.
Uh-huh.
And a flash flood came down.
Oh, wow.
During the night. And I think we had to move our tents because it's a fairly narrow camp. We were in the canyon just a little bit. I don't know what it's like now, but we were actually up in the canyon just a little bit. So we had to scurry up to the sides. But it put this big, it dumped a whole bunch of silt down into the mouth of Dark Canyon where it hit the lake. And it filled silt in underneath the J-rig.
Oh, wow.
And so the J-rig was up kind of high and dry. Maybe, yeah, I don't know. Maybe the water dropped down and the silt had been deposited. But we had to, we all were in the muck, like six or eight of us, pushing and pulling and trying to get the J-rig
off. Oh, my gosh.
That. So that was, I don't, you know, that's just, no big deal, but it was something that was memorable at the time.
Well, it's a weird thing there where the reservoir interfaces with the river. And the reservoir goes up and down, and you can get trapped there if the reservoir drops a little bit. And
yeah.
It's a mucky, goopy mess of this lake sediment.
Yeah, well, now it is. You know, when I was there, we had high water. We had
right.
the reservoir filled
right.
like in the early 80s. And so most of, I wasn't exposed much to the muck of Glen
okay.
Canyon because I think it was after I left in 86 that it really started having any kind of serious decline. And
well, it's funny because now that stuff is you know, 60 feet up these banks, and there's good little rocks poking out of Gypsum Canyon, Gypsum Rapid. So there's some really funny, neat-looking changes happening down there.
I did go through again. After I left in 86, I hadn't gone through Cataract Canyon until 2014, the 50th anniversary of Canyonlands. There was an event in Moab, and some of the old River Rangers and I showed up for it.
Oh, wow.
And we decided to do a cataract trip. So Ed was on it, I was on it, Tom Cox was on it, and then some a few other people, I can't remember exactly. But we did a cataract trip, and it was really fun to be doing a trip with them again.
Yeah.
I was surprised at how many things I couldn't remember. It's like, how did I used to run this?
Oh, my gosh.
But I did see all the silt and the lake at a much lower level.
Mm-hmm. Did you take out at height, or did you take out at North Wash?
I guess it was North Wash. It was that little skinny, it was a little skinny ramp
yep.
that came from River Wright.
Yep, North Wash.
You could only take one rig down at a time.
Yep.
The slowest, it was terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's really fascinating to look at the reservoir so low there and those changes
yeah.
down there. So,
right.
huh.
Yeah,
well,
we always took out at height and, I didn't see much of the muck.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, no, because things would have been up. And it wouldn't have been an issue. Maybe this is a good place to wrap this up, because what we'll do now from here is go to Joshua Tree.
Right.
In 85, 86.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else you want to bring into the time period we just talked about?
Well, I think I will add something just that. So I was a female on the river crew. I was just one of the boys. So while you could look at a picture and say, oh, there's a female in that crew, I never felt like I was different. I never felt like I was treated less than. I felt like I was always just another body that was working on the river crew along with these other bodies. And it was great. So
that's really neat to hear.
Yeah.
Because by that time in Grand Canyon, things were different. And it was going to get worse. And they were aware of it, that, you know, talking to those people down there and what was going on down the river scene. But I didn't get that sense from Canyonlands. And it's really neat to hear that in the 80s, you didn't either.
Right. And, you know, I kind of know of what recently has come out about the Grand Canyon River crew, what, you know, started coming out 4 or 5 years ago about the dysfunction down there. And it's my perception that there might have been more alcohol use amongst some of the people on those crews, and kind of a, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. The cataract crew were not really drinkers.
Okay.
You know? And so I don't know if that make, you know, what difference that makes. It wasn't that people were teetotalers, but they, it wasn't like a party time kind of sense when we were down on the river, just because people weren't, you know, they just weren't that. People had a few beers, you know, with dinner or something like that, but it was not maybe the atmosphere that developed on the longer trips on the Grand Canyon.
Bingo. That,
so,
you know, I was going to say there's a big difference in trip lengths. It sounds like if you were doing the spike camp down there at Spanish Bottom, you could always, you know, get in the Zodiac and go up to Moab for the evening. You know, you had...
Well, we couldn't, if we had to, but...
Right.
It was a few hours up, and you had to get a shuttle. So, I mean, that was something that never happened unless there was... One time I had to take someone out, a fellow river crew member was camped with... they were going through on cataract, and I was at the fly camp, stationed there, manning it. He got bit on the nose by a bat in the night.
Wow.
And I had to evacuate him out because nobody knew if it was a rabid bat or not.
Rabies, yeah.
So he went out. I went upstream with him the next day and evacuated him, and he got the rabies series. And now I came back. Well, you know, I dropped him off, and I went back down to Spanish Bottom. But, yeah, we didn't leave Spanish Bottom once we were on patrol unless there was some reason.
There definitely was a party component of the scene in Grand Canyon, and also the trips were much longer. I'm assuming that you were at Fly Camp for what, 4 nights, 5 nights?
Well, we were there for a week.
Okay.
But when we were at Fly Camp, it was just one person there, so party
on. That's real different.
Yeah,
good luck with that. Right.
Yeah, right. It was, and the cataract patrols were maybe 4 nights. Maybe.
Okay.
I think it was 5 day trips.
Okay.
The 4 nights, and when Tom Cox and I would go off on our Zodiac patrols, just on the flat water sections, we were out 3 or 4 nights, and neither of us was a drinker at all. So
yeah,
it just never was part of the atmosphere there.
Interesting. Yeah. It's very, very different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I remember. It was only 3 or 4 years ago we ran into one of the Canyonlands river patrols, and I asked them point blank about it, and they just looked at me like, you know, I was from Mars. They were just like, "This is not an issue here." And you know, I was like, "Okay, well, you know, you work in the system, and I'm sure you're going to say that." But it did, you know, make me think. Wow, you know, that Grand Canyon has some things to learn about this.
Yeah, I don't know why it's different, but it was a really good crew when I was there, and I have a sense that the individuals are pretty decent people since I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the female component of it, as I said, I was just another one of the boys, or just another one of the crew, and it was never an issue. It was,
yeah.
So I really enjoyed my whole Park Service career, but Canyonlands always has a special place in my heart.
Cool.
Right.
Well, with that, maybe we will wrap up part three, oral history interview with Pat Gredigan. I'll get this right.
You got it right.
Hey, working on it. You're training me. It's good. And today's Friday, November 20th, 2020, and my name is Tom Martin, and Pat, thank you so very much.